This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hi, I'm Sharad Kutan, and welcome to the show that walks you through some fundamental concepts in the social sciences and humanities. Ordinarily, I'm with Ahmad Fuad Rahmat, and we together try to show how various thinkers have grappled with theories and concepts the better to understand how society works. Each week, we discuss a classic text or an idea we hope will shed light on the world around you. Today, I'm joined by Jean-Luc Amsel and Bruno Suzerelli, who come from France, and each have their own specialty. Bruno is a person of the museum.
Yes.
And Jean-Luc is an anthropologist.
Yes.
And they both have an amazing resume. So we're not going to go through that because that will take us half the show. But I'd like to welcome both of you to the show. And I wanted to begin with the idea about anthropology in museums, because they seem to be at one level a natural fit. Many museums have that section that is anthropological, which is a showcase of societies or ethnic groups, and usually in a kind of form that is easily assimilable, understandable. They seem to be, in some ways, like insects caught in amber. They're kind of fixed in time. And maybe, Jean-Luc, you could tell us about the kind of anthropology you do and whether that image of the museum and anthropology is one that can be challenged.
Yes. And there is a strong relationship between museums and anthropology, especially what we call culture, civilization, ethnographical museum. We are not talking anymore about ethnographical museum, but now culture or civilization or society museum. So there is a strong relationship between museums and anthropology, even in the history of anthropology, because anthropology began with the collecting of artifacts in Africa, in Asia, in Latin America, in Oceania. And those artifacts were brought by the first anthropologist and exhibited in the different museums, especially, for instance, in France, the Musée de l'Homme, which is a very good example. And of course, this museum, ethnographical museum, which became now culture or society museum, exhibit artifacts which are excised from their context, from their living context, from the culture, the society from which they were extracted. And so it gave way to a kind of static anthropology. And still, for instance, the Museum of Quai Branly, which is worldwide known now, still the artifacts are exhibited as products of culture. We are conceived, we are thought of as totally static. And I challenge his vision of anthropology.
Well, it's interesting because that is the period that you're talking about in which in some ways, anthropology as an enterprise, an intellectual enterprise, was deeply complicit with colonialism,
yes,
isn't it? But the museum itself predates colonialism, or does it?
Yes,
Bruno?
Yes, it does, of course. But with colonialism, then it took anthropology in its field, and it's interesting that anthropology entered the museum not only for the others, the other civilization, the other people, but suddenly, at the end of the 19th century, it was interested by the people from the inside of a country. And for example, the museum that I'm running comes from the museum dealing with the French society, rural society, at the end of the 19th, the beginning of the 20th century. And as Jean-Luc says, it doesn't mean much now. We have to broad the project, and then we become a society museum or a civilization museum, which is even broader.
How does anthropology relate to a project, an institutional project like museums? Does it see it as a way of educating the broader public, or is it something that is quite separate from the whole enterprise of anthropology?
Well, for instance, if I If we consider the Museum of Kimberley, I think that at the origin it has been created in 2006. It was aimed at educating the young people from the suburbs, the blacks and the Berbers. Berbers is the reverse of Arabs. So the people from the, in French we say the quartier, which means the suburbs, and because it was supposed to give them a cultural background and to relate them to their supposedly original culture, and in order that they don't engage in social movement, in riots, because we had that problem in France of the riots of 2005.
But can museums stop people from rioting? I thought jobs would.
That's a hard job. I'm not sure they will do it by themselves.
But, you know, in this country, museums do have an important role, or is conceived as having an important role in nation building, in giving people a sense of focus and helping them structure their identity. Mm. So much of the museum's overt and perhaps covert agenda is, in fact, to shape people's image of themselves. Mm-hmm. Now, for an anthropologist, you know, in the whole question of how communities come into being, what culture means, isn't this in many ways the object of investigation for an anthropologist?
Yes, but as I was saying previously, I challenge this vision of cultures, of ethnicities, of ethnic groups. That was the topic of the conference, which was organized by a French embassy and KITA UKM, on the civilized and the savage. And I challenge personally, but I'm not alone in that way, this vision of culture, of society, of ethnicity as fixed entities, you know. And in fact, I know it's different from, not every culture or civilization or society museum is dealing in that way with artifacts. But for instance, while referring to the Museum of Kimberley, I think it's a way they deal with those statues, with those masks. And in my opinion, ethnic groups, for instance, I'm an Africanist, I'm not a specialist of Malaysia, but I think it's the same thing. I mean, culture, ethnic group and ethnicity has been frozen by anthropologists also, and especially with regard to the former British colonial empire, but what were called government anthropologists. The main, most important British anthropologists who worked in, for instance, in Burma, I don't know famous anthropology who worked in Malaysia, but in Burma, for instance, Edmund Leach, he was an officer. He was a very important, one of the most important anthropologists, like Evans Pritchard, for instance, or Mayer Fortis. But all of them were government anthropologists. They have been hired by the British colonial office to understand the inner functioning of those society, especially the social, the society without state, so-called segmentary societies, you know, which were difficult to understand for colonial administrators because there was no chief, only lineages, only segments, and so it was difficult to handle, difficult to govern, and so the British colonial office had to hire anthropologists to understand the inner functioning of those societies.
So this is also part of the kind of anti-insurgency, anti-resistance project of the colonial state. But just coming back to anthropology, one of the chief methodologies of anthropologists is the ethnography, right?
So participating observation.
But the idea of the ethnography as the product of this participant observation is a static, synchronic view of society. And isn't that something? How did anthropology get past that? Or is it something that is just something that we need to do? We need to have both a synchronic as well as a diachronic view of societies, that, you know, there is a sense in which we can think of things in time, also in space, and so.
So I think we have to deal with the historicity of those ethnic groups, cultures, and society. We have to do what I've done in West Africa, in Mali especially, but also in Ivory Coast and Guinea. We have to do political anthropology and historical anthropology, rely on oral tradition, interview elders, and to know how their father or their grandfather, what he was doing, and also because those societies have been those culture, whether in Africa or in Asia, in Polynesia, in Oceania, etc., they have been frozen by colonial anthropology. So we have to give them. The Americans are talking, North Americans are talking of agency. We have to give them back agency, the capacity, the ability to respond to an historical situation, especially, but not only colonial situation, because the African, the Asian people were not totally, they were not submitted totally to the colonial power. They were also reacting to the colonial. There were insurgencies and uprising and revolts and riots and so forth. So we have to deal with all those topics.
How do museums deal with that? I mean, can museums give agency to artifacts, to the history of a peoples that perhaps didn't have a literate culture, couldn't write down or articulate their own resistance to colonial power? I know people like the historian Ranajit Guha, and the Subaltern Studies School really did try to somehow find a methodology to read within colonial texts, the voice of the subaltern. But if you're working at something as practical and pedagogical as a museum, how do you give agency to those objects?
Well, we have to make them talk. Objects must talk. They must say something to people who look at them. And you have to give the context of the creation of the object, the way it was used by people, and then suddenly people understand. You don't have to write, you just can show, you can use a lot of artifacts, a lot of writing, a lot of images, photography, and so on. And for example, in the museum where I am, we have a research center, in a way, where people can come and ask to see an artifact which is in the reserves, and then he is going to know when it was collected, in which surrounded, where it comes from, and then try to understand what it means. I think that's not specially dealt with colonial or not colonial situation, but it's the way new museums work now in the field of anthropology or what we call society museums.
Do people who run museums have to keep up with the latest thinking about how societies and cultures are presented? And do you actively read, say, the work of Jean-Luc in order to, you know, to better your presentation or representation of society and culture?
Yes, of course, museum leaders, I would say, have to know what's written and what's thought about contemporary facts, and in the same time, we have to take some of distance between that, because our work is to show, is to present artifacts, pieces of art, and so on. And in my museum, for example, we have decided not to show only anthropological artifacts, but pieces of arts, contemporary art, and all kind of things which can talk about modern society, about what's happening today in the Mediterranean field, for example.
Okay, we're going to come back with a discussion about a conversation that the both of you had, you as an anthropologist, Jean-Luc, and you, Bruno, as someone who runs a museum. And I'm very interested in this conversation that you had in your museum. So we're going to be coming back very quickly. You've been listening to Jean-Luc Amsel and Bruno Zuzzarelli, both from France and who are visiting here in Malaysia. I'm Sharad Kutin. You've been listening to Night School on BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, I'm sure it couldn't. And Night School continues. We have Jean-Luc Amsel and Bruno Zuzzarelli, both from France. Bruno is a museologist, and if I could put it that way, and Jean-Luc is an anthropologist. Mm-hmm. I understand that you recently, Jean-Luc, mm-hmm. had a presentation in Bruno's museum.
Yes.
And could you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes. It was a conference organized by Bruno Zuzzarelli's museum, MUSEM in Marseille. The conference was devoted to the theme of what is the contemporaneity of the museum. And so I did the keyword address in that conference, and so I did the keynote address, and I dealt with temporalities and spaces of the museum. I mean, because in my opinion, museums have to be analyzed from the diachronical point of view, historical point of view, but also in relations with others museum, because there is also a competition between museum and even between culture, civilization, and society museum. And so, in my opinion, but it's not only the case for the topic of the museums as a social or an economic object, but I think we have to deal with geopolitics of the museum. It's my way of tackling with this matter.
Now, Bruno, when you obviously sent out that invitation to Jean-Luc, did you think that he was going to go in this direction? Is that what you wanted him to do? Or did you just want him to come have tea?
I didn't actually know what he would say, but I was very interested by this point of view. I really think that we have to have a diachronic point of view in society museums. And, for example, in MUSEM, which is my museum, we think about what is our geographical field, and we are supposed to deal with Mediterranean, but Mediterranean, what is it? So I think the object of the museum is to think about what is Mediterranean. Nobody exactly knows, or actually people don't have the same opinion of what it is, and I think it is it can be considered as a space of circulation of ideas, of persons, of merchandise. And so it's interesting to study and to talk about, especially in Marseille, where people come from all over the Mediterranean.
So the Mediterranean, of course, is partly European and partly North African, mm-hmm. isn't it? I mean, that's the cultural matrix of... And I understand there is some debate that rages about the character of Greek society, whether Greek society is just purely European and it's often portrayed as the cradle of European civilization. And I think there's a well-known thesis, the Black Athena, mm-hmm. the idea of the Afro-Asiatic roots of Greek civilization and the denial of that. Where is the debate today? Just to kind of veer off from that experiment you did and that conversation you had, where is the thinking now about what constitutes the Mediterranean?
I don't know. Jean-Luc will certainly understand better than me, but you know Braudel. Braudel was a famous anthropologist.
Historian.
And he tried to define the Mediterranean. And I don't know if it's still good, but he said it can be defined by a climate.
Exchanges between a given space.
Yes, and by an economy. Yeah. And but finally, I think it's not anymore true, because Mediterranean is something which is completely extended now. Recently, I was with the mayor of Frankfurt, the city in Germany, and he told me, I am at the head of a Mediterranean city, because he's met so many Turks who are Mediterranean, you know. And people in Berlin could say the same thing, in Paris, everywhere. So Mediterranean civilization is a topic in itself which can be asked, which can be studied independently of the country itself. Mediterranean is not only the 18 countries around the sea, you know.
So back to you, Jean-Luc. This conversation that you had, and when you made your address, what exactly were you telling the people of the museum about their museum?
A way of tackling the topic of museum very... in a way, I think I would say provocative, because it's very political, historical, and political. But so it was a bit challenging. But I think the museum likes the challenges. I think it's a very good museum. For instance, there was a very good exhibition on the Mediterranean Sea, which was called The Black
and the Blue.
The Black is a tourist vision of Mediterranean Sea with beaches.
The Blue, you mean?
The Blue, I'm sorry. The Blue is a tourist vision of the Mediterranean Sea with the beaches, sea sex and sun. Huh? And The Black is colonization and fascism, also war.
Mafia.
Fascism. And so I think those exhibitions, this exhibition in particular, is very political. So I think it's a very good, very historical and very political. But I would like to say a word about the Mediterranean Sea as a space. I think Bruno said previously that this concept of the Mediterranean Sea or Mediterranean is exploding now, because he was quoting the mayor of Frankfurt. He was saying that Frankfurt was the Mediterranean Sea. But on the other end, I mean, historians now challenge this vision of the Mediterranean such as it has been labeled and defined by Braudel, because now they see Mediterranean, this vision of the Mediterranean Sea as a colonial concept, you know, a way of bringing together, the European side and the North African side. This vision is a challenge now.
I want to just turn our attention to something, Jean-Luc, that you have developed. Correct me if I'm wrong, the French word is branchement.
Branchement, connections. Yeah, connections.
Could you just explain? Because that sounds like something that would be really relevant to a kind of Malaysian audience. I mean, we are, you know, on the Straits of Malacca, the extraordinary seaway that's, you know, been operating for a millennia or more. And we are the product of all these connections. What is it that you try to do with that idea?
I am challenging, in that book I'm challenging, but like in also in Mestizo Logics, I'm challenging the idea of local identities. In my opinion, there are no local identities, only a global signifiers, which are transformed in local signified. So while you try to define your own identity, you have to rely on the broader, what I call chains of society or chains of culture, broader spaces that you... For instance, of course, it's true now because with internet, with Facebook, with Twitter, and so forth. But even in the past, I mean... in the 18th century, there were no strict local identities, because societies, culture, ethnicities has always been encompassed within broader spaces, and so you have to rely to broader spaces to define your own local identity. Identity is always relational. It's always implied in relationships.
Now, without getting into Roland Barthes and what the meaning of signified signifier, yes. could you pin down an instance, an example of what that might be?
Yes. In Latin America, for instance, people in Venezuela or in Colombia or in Bolivia, people who define themselves African, for instance, they claim an African origin, whether they are black or not. It's not a racial matter. They define themselves not in relation or with regard to Africa, I mean the African continent. They define themselves while referring to, for instance, to TV series like Shaka Zulu or or with they refer to the work of Jean Rouch. Maybe you have heard of him, the famous movie director. Jean Rouch. So they use or Léopold Sédar Senghor, the famous poet and Senegalese poet and writer. TV series, internet, and are global signifiers, and they are reappropriated by the local actors as local signifying. That's what I mean. What I mean by branchement.
What's interesting about this local global distinction is perhaps the question of the national, because I think at least in Malaysia, the museum, Bruno, is very implicated in the question of the national. Mm-hmm. How does the museum deal with this idea of the global and the local in something like your institutional setup?
The local is perhaps no more valid, as Jean-Loup says. But contrary to you, I think it was valid. Mm-hmm. Yeah, when Levi-Strauss went to South America, of course, he found society without any interference from the outside. But now with internet, with TV, with Facebook and all that, the local doesn't mean much. But in the same time, society is completely broad, and in the same time, people have a tendency to stay with themselves and with their immediate neighbors, and then to reject the other, the person who doesn't look like them. And in France, for example, we're confronted with that, the kind of rejection of people who not like you are. So it's a kind of local repli, how would I say, returning on their identity. And, I think that's something quite embarrassing, because it's all over Europe, it's like that, you know. The other, the foreigner, the person who's not from the same ethnic than you are, can be considered as an enemy, or at least a stranger. Mm. And we have to live together. That's a real problem in Europe, not only in France.
I want to ask you, Jean-Luc, there's this idea that in our history as a species, as a being, as
mankind,
right? The stranger in these non-state tribal societies, wasn't there always the stranger? Wasn't there always the sphere of, in fact, strangers? And didn't we develop systems of recognizing and negotiating, managing those relationships with non-kin and non-community? Isn't that always been part of somehow the way we've approached the world? That suspicion is not a new thing. It's actually quite old.
Yes, absolutely. In pre-colonial Africa, West Africa, the part of Africa where I did field work, there was a strong opposition between state societies and segmentary societies, as anthropologists, lineage-based society, and state society were doing raids. They were making slaves in those segmentary societies, slaves who were then sold to traders and brought to the coast and sold to European sailors who took them to the New World. So, I mean, the opposition between local and stranger is deeply linked to the opposition between free men and enslaved in pre-colonial Africa. Slavery has been very important in Africa during the pre-colonial times. Of course, it has been suppressed by the colonial powers. What we call the underdevelopment of Africa, it is in a way linked to the slave trade era. You know, it's very important, and I think we have to deal with that topic too.
So it's interesting, because in the history of the peninsula, in the Malay Peninsula, we have a history of slavery as well. And I think Anthony Reed makes an argument that the emergence of the idea of freedom and the word merdeka really comes from the institutionalization of slavery, because once you have slaves, then you can imagine what it is to be free. Yeah, I mean, paradoxically, right? Freedom actually emerges out of a discourse discourse of what slavery might mean. I did wonder to come back to what Bruno was talking about earlier and this concern that you have about the parochialism or this turning inward and the kind of cosmopolitan or the presumption of that cosmopolitanism is a kind of progressive step for mankind, that we need to somehow embrace this cosmopolitan outlook. Is that what you were alluding to when you said that this is embarrassing, that this parochialism, this turning in, is embarrassing?
Well, it's not in reference with cosmopolitanism, but the fact that in a society where you have people coming from everywhere, they have to live together and they have to understand together each other's, one another. So if you put a barrier between your neighbor and you, then you don't have a society. You have different societies who are not able to live together. And I think the role of a museum such as mine is to make people understand better. To make people understand better on the two sides of the Mediterranean, for example, but even in Marseille itself, where my museum is located, people don't understand each other's, you see. So the museum can help for that.
Now, you know, theorists like Chantal Mouffe talk about conflict in democracies. What can anthropology teach us about the nature of conflict in human society?
If I refer to France, because I have been interested in social and economic situation in France, I think, as Bruno was saying, there's a conflict, in my opinion. I mean, there is a rise of racism, because on one hand, you have the rise of the right and extreme right, Front National, National Front, whose motto is the defense of the French of pure stock, Français de souche, French of pure stock, on the supposedly French of pure stock, because it doesn't exist.
Nobody has
a pure stock, even whether it's French or Italian or Swiss or Italian. On the other hand, you have the blacks, people coming from Africa, south of Sahara, and also Berbers, Arabs coming from North Africa, Algeria, Tunisia, and Morocco. And also they are organizing themselves along multicultural and post-colonial lines. There are several organizations like the Natives of the Republic, Les Indigènes de la République. This organization try to promote those new identities. And so there is a clash between several ethnicities. I mean, French is a Republican country. There is no room for intermediary groups. There is no room for ethnic groups. Only there is an opposition between citizens and the state. There is nothing between, because it's an inheritance from the political philosophy of the 18th century, Jean-Jacques Rousseau, etc., the general will. But in fact, what I observe, and I think it's in relation with what Bruno was saying previously, I observe as an anthropologist what I would define as an ethnicization of France. And I think we can observe this this pattern is in a lot of countries, whether it is in Europe or outside Europe. I mean, there is a rise of what I call a vertical identities. Formerly, you know, we were in the class struggle pattern, but it's over now. It's over. We have vertical identity, whether they are ethnic or LGBT. Those identities are emerging and replacing the old conflicts in terms of class struggle. I think it's a very general pattern, because it's very different from one country to another. But it's a trend. It's a dominant trend now
on a world basis, on world scale.
This is a fascinating discussion. I can see many volumes of this discussion. I hope you stay much longer. I just want to point out that, Jean-Luc, that you are the author of a book, translating the title, The Ethnicization of France, yes. Right? And is that this? Is that in that book, do you talk about precisely this?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Okay, but because, you know, for our listeners, Jean-Luc's books that are in fact translated in English, there are only two of them, of his many, Mestizo Logics, which you mentioned earlier, and Affirmative Exclusion. Now, that's fascinating. What's Affirmative Exclusion, if you could say that briefly?
But in fact, it's a book on multiculturalism. And, you know, multiculturalism is inspired of the ideas of Charles Taylor and Will Kimlicka. It's based on the recognition of cultural specificities, in fact. And it's, in principle, a very generous thought. But in fact, I think it... at least in France, because I wouldn't say it's true, it applies to all countries, especially in the United States. But in France, multiculturalism provokes, in my opinion, a rise of racism. Why, because there is no official multiculturalism in France. Officially, France is a republic, universalist republic. But in fact, there is an unofficial multiculturalism, you know, even among... among the civil servants, I mean the people of the working for the state, from the subsidized, they have been subsidizing, for instance, ethnic and religious association in the suburbs, and they are doing in a way a kind of but non-official affirmative action, and in fact produces, in my opinion, negative effects. In the French society.
Well, that's a fascinating, I think, mirror for Malaysian society. And I think that's a book I'll definitely try and pick up and see if I can, in fact, get on Amazon.
But yes, you can
definitely get
can buy it on Amazon.
Okay. Bruno, you did say that you haven't published any books. But, you know, talking about museums, what would you recommend if I happen to travel to Marseille, I might go to see your museum. But in France, or maybe in Europe, which would be the museums you would recommend as really worth observing this new practice of museum presentation and this whole absorbing of the ideas of the fluidity of cultures and the dynamics of history?
Of course, I'm not going to make some advertising for my museum, but I think it's interesting in that way. Another one is going to open soon. It's called Musée des Confluences in Lyon, and I think it's going to be very interesting because it will be about the same thing. It comes from anthropology and in the same time natural sciences, and it will treat about mankind and animal kind and everything like that, like Musée de l'Homme. And it will be very interesting on as a museography too. But you have perhaps something interesting that the division, the separation, the traditional separation between fine arts museum and society museum is now very tightened. If you go to the Louvre, you have an auditorium where you have a lot of conferences and so on. You can see contemporary art too. You can understand concerts and so on. And the same way in the museum, we try to be a space of discussion of, and we try to show movies and concerts and so on. So museums today tend to be about the same. I mean, there are kind of big cultural centers, such as Centre Pompidou was at the beginning and is still there, actually.
We'd like to continue this conversation. I don't know if you gentlemen are on Facebook. Are you? Well, so Jean-Louis is not on Facebook. Bruno, can you
admit
to it? Neither are you. Okay, but we do have a Facebook page. It's BFM Night School. But if you'd like to have a question or something, a point of clarification, you can always write to us at bfmnightschool@gmail.com and we will forward it to Bruno and Jean-Louis. So I'm on Twitter. Either of you on Twitter?
No,
Bruno.
My museum is, but not me personally.
What is your museum's Twitter handle?
Museum. org, O-R-G is the site.
The handle. Yeah, the handle. Oh, no, it's the website.
The website.
Okay, do you have a Twitter?
Yes, but I can't remember.
Well, we'll put it on our Facebook page. Well, we'll look it
there
up.
There is an
okay,
address,
of course. Wonderful. Thank you so much for joining me this evening. I've been talking to Jean-Luc Amsel and Bruno Suzzarelli. We've been talking about museums, anthropology, and multiculturalism, and a whole range of things. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
This has been Night School. I'm Sharad Kutan, BFM 89.9, The Business Station.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.